Hello, you're listening to History of Gore, a stumbling, screaming chase through the darkened woods of the past. With me in pursuit, James Hoare. Either I'm a huntsman or a wolf or something, but I'm definitely not a sexual predator. I'd like to get that out there right now. We're sticking with Africa. Last episode, we were talking about the gruesome rites and battlefield rituals of the Zulu, especially around the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879, which I'd recently written over 100,000 words on for publication in a special bookazine. That 100,000 words thing wasn't an exaggeration. That's literally how many words I wrote. It's quite something. Anyway, if you want to pick up a copy of Zulu, the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879, you can order it online from shop.keypublishing.com. And that's key as in the thing you have in a key ring and not the place where boat dock, which I always thought was pronounced quay. Until I was like 12 or something. No, it's not like a recent thing I'm alluding to there. We've moved up the continent this week to West Africa. And we're going to be talking about the leopard man murders of the late 19th century and early 20th century. So listen closely for the scratching of claws on hardwood floors. In the 1930s, a German missionary medic called Dr. Werner Junger travelled to the Republic of Liberia, and writing two decades later in his clunkily titled memoir, African Jungle Doctor, 10 Years in Liberia, I mean, it's the most German title for a book ever, isn't it? He recounted this particularly gruesome chapter in excruciating detail. I'm going to put on a bit of a sort of amicus, hammer, narrator, Van Helsing type voice as opposed to a German voice, because my comedy German accent's a little bit too kinky leather daddy. There on a mat in the house, I found the horribly mutilated body of a 15-year-old girl. The neck was torn to ribbons by the teeth and claws of the animal. The intestines were torn out, the pelvis shattered, and one thigh was missing. A part of the thigh was gnawed to the bone, and a piece of the shin bone lay near the body. It seemed at first glance that only a beast of prey could have treated the girl's body in this way, but closer inspection brought certain particularities to light which did not fit in with the picture. And Dr. Junger obviously fancies himself as a little bit of a hand Van Helsing, and he doesn't really go into that much detail about what these particularities are. But a girl, he believed, had been butchered by a West African cult known as the Leopard Society, which by that time had been firmly established in the imagination of white settlers, mainly French, Belgian and British, as a bogeyman haunting colonial nightmares. There's a few things that are quite problematic about Dr. Junger, both as a source and as a human being. Mainly that he's writing two decades after the fact. He's describing something that happened during the sort of the peak of a tabloid outrage, which can't possibly be verified by anybody else. And really, he's just sort of reinforcing some fairly kind of ugly stereotypes. And you know, consider the age of him to have been an active kind of German missionary in the 1930s. He's really the product of views on black Africans which aren't exactly woke AF. Anyway, at the heart of this kind of leopard society, leopard man murder story is this very basic and understandable fear that white European settlers had of this vast black population rising against them. and the retributions for the sins of empire that they were, you know, trying to brush under the carpet would come back to haunt them. But the mythology also reflects this kind of racist vision of black Africans as being somehow animalistic or primal or superstitious or uncivilized, and this paranoia that no matter how much glorious Christianity or capitalism or steam trains or petticoats whitey brings to Africa, you know, the dark continent of sort of the colonial imagination is still lurking just underneath the surface. When the so-called leopard man killings reached their peak between 1890 and 1930, although the British House of Commons was debating leopard society murders in Nigeria as recently as 1956, and in this age of, you know, endless Brexit debates, it feels, I don't know, I'm weirdly nostalgic for a time I wasn't even alive for, that the House of Commons could have the, you know, the luxury of sitting around talking about people dressed as leopards. Newspaper reports described hooded Africans with their robes spotted like a leopard's hide and blades wielded in their fists like claws, striking in the dead of night and seemingly at random victims. The leopard men would attack from behind, slit their target's throat, and then vanish into the darkness to leave them bleeding out. And with the shock of these murders giving way to hearsay and hatred, the Leopard Society were additionally said to have mutilated their victims, severed their heads, disguised their presence with animal tracks, and even consumed body parts in an act of cannibalism. And although similar stories surfaced, you know, with all manner of animalistic variants, such as the lion men, the crocodile men, baboon men, the leopard man panic focused primarily on the Congo, which retained an aura of mystery and terror right into the first decades of the 20th century. We're going to turn the clock back a couple of decades now, because explaining the context of the Congo Basin is really important to understanding where this fear of colonial retribution and sort of vengeance being visited upon Africa's white settlers emerge from. And it also helps you understand the insidious shadow that's cast by the Congo that made this such a kind of fertile ground for fear and paranoia and moral panic. Now, the Congo, which was a hot and humid land of dense jungle, mountain and sheltered valleys, you know, notoriously far from the gaze of even the most seasoned European observers of African affairs, became the personal property of King Leopold II of Belgium in 1885. Now, this was under the name of the Congo Free State. Now, that's not the same thing as the Belgian Congo. The Congo Free State had nothing to do with the Belgian government. It was the personal property of the Belgian king. It was a constitutional, democratic, quote-unquote modern monarch at home. But in Africa, he was an autocratic feudal tyrant. And this was his personal domain, and the people who worked there little more than serfs. Now, over the early 1900s, increasingly grim news began to filter through to the west of forced labourers in Leopold's rubber plantations being whipped and murdered for failing to meet their production targets, and of severed hands being collected in baskets as proof that they had been suitably punished. Now, this colonial outrage was criticised by everyone from Sherlock Holmes creator Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to the great American novelist Mark Twain. And obviously Joseph Conrad wrote his legendary novel Heart of Darkness, which was with a transformed setting, was adapted as Apocalypse Now, the great sort of misanthropic Vietnam War movie. Now, this kind of these sort of punishment killings and mutilations were joined by war, uprising and disease to account for anywhere between 5 and 10 million dead. Now, Historians still debate whether or not this classifies as a genocide of the Congolese, and the Belgian government reluctantly intervened and prized the colony from their murderous king's grasp in 1908. But this aura of tragedy and bloodshed lingered, and the events that we're talking about with the Leopard Man murders took place 1, 2, 3 decades following the atrocities in the Congo Free State. To get back to the Leopard Man murders, there's no greater testament to how widespread and well-known these stories are than seeing them brush up against two undisputed cultural icons of the early 20th century, Tarzan and Tintin. In 1935, the American adventure writer Edgar Rice Burroughs made it the subject of his 18th Tarzan novel, Tarzan the Leopard Man, and the second volume of Tintin, published in 1932 by the Belgian writer and artist Heger, which I'm fairly sure is not how you pronounce his name, but I feel as though I've lent into it and disguised my linguistic ineptitude by giving you an exaggerated Franco-Belgian pronunciation, featured the Leopard Man in Tintin in the Congo, which was re-released, I think, a few years ago as Tintin in Africa, maybe? All I can remember is incredibly controversial and racist and had a little kind of card belly band around it to keep it sealed so that kiddie-winks wouldn't accidentally flick through it in Waterstones and be exposed to some horrendous racism. There's a controversial statue of a leopard man standing over his slumbering victim, which takes pride of place at the Royal Museum for Central Africa in Belgium. And that's kind of totemic of the whole debate. It's part sort of ethnographic display and part sculpture. There's the cast figure of the leopard man kind of leering over the sleeping victim as if he's, you know, in Nosferatu or something. But the statue is wearing quote-unquote authentic leopard man outfit. He's got the sort of the Catwoman headdress on, the leopard skin cloak and dressing, and he's got his kind of leopard claws on his hands. Now, to describe these, obviously the podcast isn't an ideal medium for talking you through sculpture and weapons, but this is the sorry state we find ourselves in, so you're just gonna have to fire up the old mind tank and let me talk you through it. Now imagine the leopard claws like knuckle dusters. Your fist closes on a grip and the blades push through the three gaps in your fingers to create this sort of this three spiked weapon, which is fine. And I can understand how the leopard claws can kill someone, wound somebody, can even slit someone's throat. But even contemporary sources noted how impractical this was as a weapon. And if you really, really think about it, yes, you could kill someone, you could wound someone, you could definitely have someone's eye out with the leopard claws. There's an Indian weapon which uses a very similar sort of modus operandi, the punch dagger, which was designed to be used as a kind of a stabbing or, if need be, a slashing weapon. So 100% the leopard claws could kill someone, and they could arguably be quite effective. They could be easily hidden, whatever else. But the problem is, I don't think you could sever somebody's head with the leopard claws. And also, I don't know how you could sneak up behind somebody and cut their throat with the leopard claws. Now, ball your hand into a fist and try and maneuver it into the position where you are sliding your knuckles across someone's jugular. You can't. Your arms do not bend like that. The only throat you can get your leopard claws into is your own. And then the costume, too, is massively impractical. If you're prowling around the Congo Basin at night, sneaking into huts or clambering over verandas to murder the inhabitants. Firstly, do you need a mask? Secondly, how is the reduced visibility of a leopard mask going to help you? Thirdly, it's not exactly inconspicuous to prowl around dressed as a leopard, given that the kind of the leopard man murder moral panic ran for three decades. So it's not even like people be pointing and going, why is that guy dressed like a leopard? You know, late 1920s, early 1930s, they'd be pointing going, oh, look, Deirdre, it's one of those leopard man murderers. Perhaps the most rational explanation for the leopard man garb and the leopard man weapons is that the accounts of these crimes became garbled in their translation between the witnesses and the first responders and the colonial authorities. Now, in Congolese folk belief, charms could imbue their holders with the power of specific animals, such as the grace and power of a leopard. And this concept could have been misunderstood by white Europeans to mean that they were literally disguised as leopards. Historians have also observed that the methods of the Leopard Society are perhaps closer to a resistance movement or a terrorist organisation. You know, part freedom fighters and part mafioso. They use protection rackets, extortion, vendettas and punishment to displace colonial government and colonial police in remote corners of West Africa. And this is quite similar to the internal mythology of the Cosa Nostra. The idea that those organisations formed in Sicily and similar organisations formed in southern Italy in order to protect their communities, and then that protection kind of morphed into protection rackets and honour codes and things like that. Now, I know the most closely associated with Congo for a series of colourful reports and murder trials in the 1920s. The first accounts of leopard man murders came from the British colony of Sierra Leone and the French colony of Gabon in the 1870s. Now, leopards are widely found across West African folklore and heraldry, including the coat of arms of the modern Democratic Republic of Congo, and the leopard symbolises authority. Now, therefore, the use of leopard imagery may have been a motif for traditional African tribal authority as a counterpoint to the supposed authority of the white colonial governments, which fits with that resistance interpretation. Like, basically, villagers in Congo and elsewhere are being asked to follow the lead of the leopard rather than the British Empire's lion. Also, it could affect the way that these crimes were perceived when villagers and witnesses and things like that kind of attributed their attacks to leopards. Did they just mean that it was the work of the kind of the anti-colonial and anti-imperialist sort of bandits and mafioso that were hiding out in remote rural areas? Now, African oral histories, which have been passed down through the generations, give the movement its origins in the 1700s as a group of warriors who banded together to protect their people from slavers. And like the leopard, they were said to consume the flesh of their enemies. Now, we've got to take this with a pinch of salt, because oral histories are, you know, by definition, a little bit wonky. They take on larger-than-life characteristics with each telling in order to become kind of more heroic or more villainous or more memorable. But it is worth noting that belief in the powers of cannibalism to confer the abilities of the deceased, or the magical properties of potions and charms and other medicines, which have been kind of either brewed from human blood or kind of manufactured through human organs that have been ground to dust and the like, are very widespread in the region. So again, it becomes very, very difficult to separate fact from folklore. As the vast majority of societies in West Africa, fact and folklore, there wasn't really a boundary between the two. Now, that the Leopard Society was more than just a gang of directionless slugs and killers obviously did not register to the white elites who ruled over them, and they refused to credit black Africans of any higher motive than superstition, bloodlust, and barbarism. Basically, as these crimes happened, there wasn't a willingness to understand any larger motives or get to grips with what the Leopard Man murders were saying about the limitations or the attitudes towards white colonial authority. Now, unfortunately, it'll be a very, very long time before we know for certain what occurred in this dark period of African history, as many of the police files remain sealed in Belgium and France. As you said, the peak of this phenomenon was in the 1920s, and reports continued well into the 1950s, which means they're not yet eligible for release into the public domain. So all that we're left with, for now at least, and for the next decade or two, are the lurid newspaper reports and particularly tasteless museum exhibits, which speak exclusively of white anxieties towards the vast lands that they ruled and the fear of those lands slipping from their grasp. You've been listening to History of Gore, Episode 6, The Leopard Man Murders, Cults, Conspiracies, and White Foolishness. I've no idea what we're going to be talking about next episode. We probably won't be sticking around in Africa, though, because I'll have become obsessed by something else by that point. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, if you want to get in touch, you can find me on Twitter at JDHore, H-O-A-R-E. And just give me a follow or shoot me a message and tell me that you love me and massage my email. Massage my email? Massage my ego. You can massage my email if you like. I think that means send me a dick pic or something. I'm not sure. Anyway, I've said too much now. Nighty-night.